When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Whether you're a brand, large business, small business, or an individual, you need customers. And the chances are some of your potential customers are probably listening to this podcast right now. From history...
When Napoleon led Boulogne for a year...
Politics...
If that person is poor, it's a bad neighbourhood. Then you have the disproportionate police brutality, which is meted out instantly at people of colour.
Culture...
Had they written it that Chris called an ambulance for hours straight away, we wouldn't have learnt about the severity of alcohol withdrawal either. Well done to the writers. Thank you for making a wonderful podcast, but I'd give Rotherham a miss. Bye!
The Rotherham Tourist Board.
Geekdom.
The flag is a graphic symbol, not a verbal symbol. You know, why don't we just write France on the flag? I mean, we laugh when you think of putting a country's name on a flag.
Society or music.
Young people began to turn away from their parents' ethics and their style of dress, and they began to dance to a new type of music.
Royfield Brown's podcasts are downloaded just under 100,000 times a month. So putting your message here could well be worth it. If you have something to sell or promote, why not email royfield@gmail.com and hear your product or service promoted.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Let's get Brexit done.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
Hello and welcome to Mid-Atlantic, the show where we look at the news and the views from one side of the Atlantic from the perspective of the other. I'm Royfield Brown, who's about to leave the Bay Area and go to Canada for Christmas. And today we are joined by Clint Losey, ex-Capitol Hill staffer in Washington, writer Emma Burnell in Walthamstow in London, and the political commentator and TV pundit Laura Babcock in Hamilton, Ontario. Say hello, folks.
Hiya.
Hello.
Hey.
In a week that has seen a 90-year-old woman become the UK's first coronavirus vaccine recipient, we ask if split-screen America is here to stay.
And even the New York Times wrote articles about how dangerous mail-in voting was. This is the first time we ever did it en masse, and I think we proved that all three are prophets. It's not only susceptible to fraud, it is easily susceptible to fraud, particularly if you have a plan or scheme which sounds eerily similar to what Joe Biden told us a few days before the election, that he had the best voter fraud team in the world. Well, they were good. I don't know that they were that good because they made significant mistakes, like all crooks do.
Joining us now is Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro. Pennsylvania is, of course, one of the states being sued by Texas and 17 other Republican-controlled states that are trying to have Pennsylvania's election results thrown out.
I was going to use a more diplomatic phrase like uniquely unserious to describe the lawsuit. And it is based on debunked tweets and conspiracy theories, lies that haven't held up in court. And now we find ourselves with the president and some of these attorneys general trying to spin their wheels and thwart the will of the people in at least four states.
You and your fellow attorneys general from Michigan and Wisconsin issued a statement after this lawsuit was filed, calling it an insignificant attempt. You said these insignificant attempts to disregard the will of the people in our states mislead the public and tear at the fabric of our Constitution.
There seems to be two Americas, one red and blue, an America which doesn't consume the same media, one where voter fraud is rife and one where Joe Biden is quietly assembling his new administration. This week, we had assessments of the coronavirus pandemic from President Trump. It's been a medical miracle. You know what? Medical miracle is not an easy thing to say, right? if you're not prepared for it. And President-elect Joseph Biden warning that a very dark winter is ahead. Is this two-speed America here to stay, or can the Biden administration get all Americans singing from the same hymn sheet during his administration? Over to you, Clint Losey in Washington.
Yeah, you're definitely seeing a huge split between people on the left and people on the right in terms of how they view the world. And the coronavirus has definitely exacerbated that. Some of that comes down to just geographic distribution. You have a lot of conservatives in rural areas. You have a lot of Democrats and liberals in cities, and they were just hit differently with the coronavirus when it came up earlier this year. So that's really exacerbated those differing viewpoints, not just on the virus and public health itself, but you know, it's kind of retrenched a lot of the partisan viewpoints that preceded that.
You have hinted at what I'm about to say in your answer, that the coronavirus has been the focal point for this kind of difference, whether you people wearing masks or not, is one key thing. But it goes much deeper than that, doesn't it? That we do have this split screen narrative in terms of voter fraud, let's say. There are some Americans, not all Trump voting Republicans, but goodly amount of Americans that believe that, let's say, voter fraud is rife. And they are looking at these press briefings that Rudolph Giuliani is doing. And then there are a goodly amount of other Americans that believe that this was the most safest and secure election and that Biden has legitimately won the election. Very obviously, a country can't survive in the long term where two sets of people fundamentally do not agree on facts. The question really for the three of you, I'm going to start with you, Clint, because you are our resident American. How can the Biden administration get Americans eventually in the next 4 years to sing from the same hymn sheet that there aren't people disputing facts with their own alternative facts?
It's going to be a tremendous challenge. You may have seen an interview with former President Obama in, I think it was The Atlantic, and he kind of talked about the split between what you might call two Americas. And the idea of an epistemic breach between the left and right is not new. You definitely saw that after Trump was elected, but it definitely goes back to 2008 and the Tea Party. And I'm sure that there's a longer study would kind of lay out, you know, how it came to be. Biden is going in to office against a long-standing issue that's dividing the country. And one of the things that kind of really worries me about how he navigates that is that this is not just the kind of the two sides to every issue paradigm that you may have seen in more normal times. It's not simply that Republicans are doubling down and tripling down on their viewpoint. It is something a little bit more psychological than that. And it's really kind of stark how they are dividing the political sphere, that everyone is either good or bad. People who agree with them are good, people who disagree with them are bad. And you see how Donald Trump, who is a walking contradiction of decency, but he's wrapped in this mythos of honor and virtue by his supporters. And on the other hand, you have John McCain and Mitt Romney, who are actually fairly decent guys, and they've just been totally vilified. I personally have difficulty seeing how that viewpoint is sustainable through all of the massive contradictions. And that's really what Joe Biden is going up against. How he combats that is going to be a long process. And he's going to have to be very patient to kind of draw those people back into a more normal perception of reality, really.
Emma Burnell, the word of the day is epistemic. I'm having to look into my mental thesaurus to understand what that word means, but I think I've just about got the meaning of it. Do we have an epistemic breach in UK politics, or can we say that this is purely or wholly an American phenomena?
It's definitely not just an American phenomena. We're seeing this kind of division all around the world, alongside the rise of strong men like Viktor Orban or Jair Bolsonaro, Erdogan in Turkey. You know, this is not simply a Western phenomena. It's not simply a American phenomena, but America is where we see it played out at its most TV-friendly, I suppose, would be the way to put it. What Donald Trump did was take political differences and turn them into a game show, because that's who he is. He's a game show contestant. He's a game show host. And I think there are important ideological differences that we don't talk about enough because we're too busy talking about the ephemera, the crap.
When I think of Canadian politics, I don't think of the vitriol that we get in American politics. And that the vitriol which is starting to creep into UK politics, using your southern neighbour as an example, why do you think that Canadian politics is much kinder, at least when it comes to rhetoric? Yes, there are ideological differences, but they don't seem to be as, there doesn't seem to be the epistemic, using Clint's word, breach in Canadian politics at the moment compared to your southern neighbour.
Well, there's a number of reasons. One of them being that we've always, at least in the recent history, had a three-party system, if you will, within our parliamentary system. We have a third party that is kind of the party of conscience, the NDP. People think, they'll probably never govern, but they always manage to certainly broker deals to keep Canada a little bit nicer and to the left during something like the minority parliament situation that we have. It keeps people from being 100% bifurcated, right? You can be liberal, you can be conservative, you can be NDP, you can be a blend thereof. It's a little bit more difficult to get this devotion to one side and devote generationally to one side like we see in the US with people who've always voted Republican, always voted Democratic. It's almost as though, it's kind of like God party country in the US. And in Canada, I would suggest it's really none of those three. That's just not how we navigate ourselves. We are who we are. We think of ourselves more as being Canadians in search of our own identity and much less so ascribing to the identity of a particular political party. And if you even look at the history of the political right in this country, it keeps breaking and changing and morphing. So we just don't have a grand old party, and we just don't have, so much of the baggage and the bifurcation that we see with our neighbors in the South. One thing, though, that we do see is a whole lot of garbage creep coming in through the media and also through our social media. We've seen it creep into our politics. We often see sort of shadows of US vitriol and US advertising and US campaigns, but we never sort of see it full-throated, because I think that here in Canada, we're kind of resistant to that. It's not working out so well for our neighbors in the South. And, even if you looked up to the US as I did as a young child, now, just watching the pandemic, every time we look at a map of our pandemic in Canada, we see, of course, the US because we share the border and most of us live along it. And it looks like they're on fire compared to our worst red zones, right? So we always have this juxtaposition between the two countries, and the pandemic has just put that into stark relief. We don't want to be like the Americans. No offense to our colleague on the program, but I think Canadians are very wary of that kind of political partisanship and that kind of vitriol and that kind of garbage.
Talking about vitriol and garbage, and is it bifurcation? Was that your word of the show? All right, well, thank you.
Gotta keep up, come on.
Right. Colin, specifically, we've had small little forest fires in the Republican Party, specifically Arizona, some of its members saying that the party echelon shouldn't have certified the results of the election. How important is this going forward? Is this just a case of a little bit of local difficulty? Or are we potentially seeing the fight for the soul of a non-Trumpian Republican Party going forward?
I do think it's important, kind of to answer the last part of that first, is that I think the battle for the soul of a non-Trumpian party has already been lost. The never-Trumpers were, in fact, kicked out. And, it's been a difficult thing to be a Republican and not be a Trump supporter. But I do think that one of the big questions is how the Republicans are going to go forward after Trump leaves office. I think one of the big expectations that a lot of people had was that if the Republicans lost big in the election, that they would in fact go through something of an internal bloodbath. I already have my word of the day, so I won't call it an internecine bloodbath, but you're looking at how the blame game for the Republican Party is going to go. That could still happen if the Democrats win both seats in Georgia and take control of the Senate. You could see something like that. But I think that there's just so many incentives for the Republican Party to hold on and maintain some amount of cohesion against the Democrats that I'm a little skeptical that a big breakdown in the party is going to happen.
Clint, you look like a man to me that likes to go to Las Vegas and bet all on black, right? You look like that type of chap, as we would say in the UK. Put your money where your mouth is, sir. What is going to be the outcome of those two special races in Georgia?
I think the Republicans are going to win. I really would like to see the Democrats take those seats. I think that would be a great accomplishment. But I think that Georgia is a very deeply red state. I think that there are a lot of officials that have demonstrated recently as 2018, that they are willing to put their thumb on the scale, that there's just a lot of structural headwind, if you want to say it, against the Democrats in those races.
So we're going to have a split government for the next 4 years. You heard it here first, folks, from Clint Losey. If he's wrong, email him, not me. Emma Burnell, Georgia, is it deeply red or isn't it kind of purple now? I thought we had Stacey Abrams and her great work there getting out the African-American vote, etc., changing demographics. What are the chances that Clint Losey, the man who likes to bet big in Las Vegas, is wrong?
They're not zero. I think Clint's probably right on the average probability. If I were going to put money on it, I'd probably put money on the Republicans holding those seats. But that's not to say, I mean, the Democrats are currently in the lead in polls. What does that mean? You know, who gives a crap what the polls are saying? Definitely the trend is going in the Democratic direction. It's definitely a more purple state than it has been for a very long time. Things like the Atlanta suburbs are becoming more liberal and more Democrat. So the more that remains the trend, the closer the Democrats can take it to the Republicans in terms of contesting Georgia.
Laura, I am really quite fascinated about this difference between your average modal Canadian and with your average modal American. And I kind of say this all the time. You guys are a little bit more sober, a little bit more rational and a little bit calmer. And I say this with this in mind, that some of these court cases that Donald Trump's legal team are trying to hawk around the United States are kind of based around this notion that Hugo Chavez has had a hand in the American elections because the company that makes the voting machine software is Venezuelan. And of course, it's all part of a massive conspiracy. For our American cousins, for our American friends, why do conspiracy theories, political conspiracy theories, not seem to take hold in Canada? What is it about the makeup of Canada where people just generally don't go in for that type of fantasy, would you say?
Well, I wish I could say that we didn't. I'm seeing an alarming increase in it, even at our local city level.
Undercut my question, Laura.
Well, I'm always going to give you the true answer. our city council, it sounds downright Trumpian, calling us a cabal and saying that there's like a conspiracy against them, like bizarre language that in 25 years of following and having local shows I've never seen before. And where does that license come from? That license comes from the normalization of conspiracies in the mainstream from Trump and his megaphone and his fantastic skills, which are, you know, he's the Barnum and Bailey. He's the flim-flam man of the world, of history, right? And so I have seen that creep coming into the country. Why do we not embrace it kind of wholesale? Because as I said, again, we're not sort of so branded by a certain party that as soon as that party gets taken over by a cult leader, we suddenly all become part of the cult. So it's a little easier to have a little bit of a intellectual distance from some of the ideas and some of the rhetoric that's tested by our politicians. I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is if you're like, you know, the younger sibling and you look up and you see your older, bigger sibling always getting in trouble for doing stupid stuff, you kind of say to yourself, I really don't want to get in that kind of trouble with mom and dad, right? Like, this doesn't look fun. I think the other issue too is that we're not armed to the teeth. I mean, part of what I see going on in the U.S., you know, people showing up armed to the houses of people who are just working the electoral system. I mean, that stuff is bananas. And in Canada, we just simply are not weaponized like that to the teeth. We're not a population that has an orientation towards violence. The U.S. is very much a combative country, legally, physically, we're just not. You know, we come from a different background. You said off the top, we're more sober. I'm not sure we're more sober. Canadians do enjoy altering ourselves a lot, but we're definitely not as violent. And we're definitely not as entrenched ideologically in this country for, I think, the reasons that I cited. And there's probably a whole host more going all the way back to how we were founded.
Clint's going to leave the last word on this view. Bifurcated. What was your word again there, Clint?
Epistemic breach.
Epistemic breach. Why has there been an epistemic breach? No, we won't say that. Please explain to the rest of the world what's happened to Rudolph Giuliani. He hasn't got control of his colon. In the middle of hearings, he's loudly flatulent. His hair dye is running down his brow. And he's obviously lost all semblance of sense that he once had. More than, 3,000 Americans died yesterday because of COVID, which is 1.5 times more people that died in 9/11. And at that moment, he was America's mayor, New York's mayor, and actually showed clear, strong leadership. What's happened to a once great man, Clint?
I think that in 20 or 40 years, when the history books are written, no one is going to believe that Rudy Giuliani was a real person at this time. I just have no idea how he's going to appear in our history books in another generation or two. But I do think there are some factors that have contributed to not just his own, kind of split from reality, but to how a lot of people in the country follow him to that place. One of those is kind of the do your own research movement. And this goes to particularly the conservative effort to delegitimize experts, scientists, economists, historians. The idea that people should do their own research is also a hallmark of conspiracy theories like QAnon. But it doesn't mean do your own research. It really means don't listen to the experts who have really done the research. It's about delegitimizing them. That allows people to go into the petri dish of social media, where, you know, there is no gatekeeper for what's a good idea or a bad idea. They can pick and choose from all of these, this whole buffet of bad ideas and conspiracy theories. And then they've sealed themselves off from alternative worldviews and any challenge to that vision. And in the United States, that means not just sealing themselves off from mainstream news and sealing off their social media environment. It also means that they've kind of sorted themselves politically into communities that are Democratic communities or Republican communities. So I think when you put all of that together, you get this echo chamber or just this worldview that allows for things like Rudy Giuliani and the claims of voter fraud and all of that.
I think it's even more sinister than that. As soon as there is that orientation towards social media, the algorithms in social media keep feeding that demon, right? They'll keep taking you down.
Absolutely,
and down.
Yeah.
And I think we're just beginning to understand the impact. Even I'm always fascinated, you know, Twitter finds for me what it thinks will extend my own perception bias. And so you have to keep pushing yourself out of your own trends that are showing up, right? So we're very much being manipulated for the purpose of being for commerce. And I think that as people realize that, hopefully, and I know that isn't today the day that Facebook is having to face down congressional oversight for their complicity in so much of this and where they are as social media giants. So, you know, it's not just that people are being easily duped or being intellectually lazy. We are being manipulated at a level we don't even understand. And as we dig into that and hopefully put some kind of framework around that, it will enable people to have a broader appetite for information.
Mm. Wise words. Let us move on.
Morning, Topshop in Cardiff opened as normal, and it will continue to for now. Arcadia is in administration, but it's still trading, and no redundancies have been announced yet. The company blames coronavirus, but Arcadia's sales were on the slide long before lockdown. In a statement tonight, the chief executive said, "This is an incredibly sad day for all of our colleagues, as well as our suppliers and our many other stakeholders. The impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, including the forced closure of our stores for prolonged periods, has severely impacted impacted on trading across all of our brands. Sir Philip Green bought Arcadia 18 years ago and really hit the big time. He already controlled BHS and had appeared to transform its fortunes. Green went on to enjoy success with access to celebrities and prime ministers. He was knighted in 2006, but his fortunes changed dramatically. First, BHS went bust a year after he sold it. Now the rest of his empire has crumbled. Arcadia is in administration along with its eight brands, 13,000 staff and 400 shops. The administrator, Deloitte, will try to sell the loss-making business as a whole, or failing that, parts of it. The aim will be to raise as much money as possible for Arcadia's creditors, those who are owed money. They include banks, suppliers, the pension scheme, the taxman, landlords and Sir Philip's family.
The first week of December has brought a big blow to the UK high street, with more than 26,000 jobs gone. Bon Marsh has joined Debenhams and the Arcadia Group, the owner of Topshop and Dorothy Perkins, in collapsing into administration. Emma, has COVID killed the UK high street and, dare I say, Main Street for our American cousins around the world?
I think COVID has exposed trends that were coming anyway. The high street has long been falling out of fashion as the way that we shop. The internet has long been taken.
I see what you did there, falling out of fashion, me talking about Topshop. You're good.
I'm so good. I'm so good I didn't even realise I'd done it. I mean, it's quite funny for me because I'm just getting to the age where I might have started shopping at Dorothy Perkins. Basically, the Arcadia Group never really grasped online commerce at all. Other high street brands did much better at moving themselves into that space. Philip Green never really got it. He was, you know, very poo-pooing. Oh, people always want to try clothes on, and it's just not turned out to be that way. There is a real need to think about how we have communal space still, because that it doesn't have to be around commerce, but we should have spaces where we gather, whether that means more going back to hopefully having more social space, restaurants, theatres, arts venues, whether that means civic space, so places where we can just be and gather together. Because I think what's missing with the high street, partly it's jobs. Jobs is a huge, huge issue. If we don't have retail jobs, what do we have? Usually warehouse packers who are paid considerably worse. But also what we miss is, you know, the places where we gather together, where we see other people. And if this year has taught us anything, it's that we really, really miss seeing other people.
Emma's just made me think, because I utterly believe in the commons, that space where we all come and meet. I believe in it intellectually and I believe in it physically. You know, the commons was the common ground. Where do we stand with Warner Brothers basically saying that they're going to not put out their movies, or at least the same day as they go in cinemas, they're going to be on a streaming service, on HBO Max. Many people are seeing this is going to be the death of the cinema throughout the world. How important is that going to be for us to have another avenue whereby COVID hasn't necessarily killed the common space, but accelerated trends that were there before? Whenever I tell the story of me watching Black Panther, key to that cinematic experience were the whoops and the hollers and the gasps, because I watched it in Oakland, and it's the first scene is in Oakland, California. Ditto the death of Spider-Man in Infinity War, when the woman next to me was crying. She said, "Oh no, not Peter, not Spider-Man 2. Laura, you're nodding away sagely. If cinemas go, how important a loss will that be for all of us around the world?
I don't know that it's going to be stay or go. I think it's going to change. So a lot of us during COVID who had the means to probably upgraded our tech, created home theaters in anticipation. And so we've got a pretty nice setup, right? Nice and safe at home. And if you really want to make it interactive, I'm sure they'll figure out a way to stream it with a live chat or some sort of a function so we can get the oops and ahs and little hearts flying up. You know, if we want to have that sense of community, they'll figure it out. I think it might open up the door to more live theater, to using those stages and those venues. I'm not talking about going back to Dionysius or anything, but this idea of let's do the things we can't do on TV. So I kind of look at it as like taped theater and live theater, and Emma's far more astute at all of this than I am. So maybe all of those spaces can be changed, right? The function of them can be changed. I personally have never found movies as a particularly communal event. I mean, I do remember people clapping at the end of Titanic, and you know, and I ran to two theaters.
What?
To
watch when when the ship went down, people applauding that.
No,
you Canadians are dark.
I think we're way nicer than we are. We're actually quite evil, which is more subtle. But no, I mean, like, you can remember great films being applauded, and, you know, Jurassic World, when it came out, I forget which one it was called. I think Jurassic World, we ran between theaters to see it twice back to back on the big screen, right? So there is some of that, but let's face it, going to a movie is what you do when you have a date. You don't really want to talk to them and don't know what to do. You sit in the movie theater in the dark and have your own experience. So I just don't.
Whoa, Laura. Clint, what did you do in the cinema in the dark on a date, Clint? This I want to hear.
I'm not answering this question.
Depends what row you're sitting in. If you're in the back row, it's a little different.
Clint, as well as a man that obviously likes to go to Las Vegas and bet big, you're the type of man that's on the back row of a dark cinema, aren't you, Clint?
I do love to go to the movies. I'm not going to disclose where in the theater I sit, but I do go to the movies a lot. It's a special experience for me, and it's been one of the devastating parts of the pandemic. The theaters aren't open, and I'm pretty shocked at Warner Brothers' move. I think it's terrible. I do think movies are a communal experience. I think we're going to be looking for more of those in communities. One of the things that's happening in DC is that the public transportation is being cut because ridership is down and they don't have the funding for it. And that's going to have a huge impact on not just movie theaters, but a lot of stuff like how people gather, where people go. You know, are people going to go down to the mall if they can't ride the metro to get there? And so, you know, what does that mean for neighborhoods? So it's not just movie theaters. I think you're right, Royfield, that it's going to be a lot of different ways of how we connect in our communities.
There was a big protest at our Hamilton City Hall for 13 days. People stood outside in the freezing cold trying to get a meeting with the mayor to talk about emergency housing. And one of the things that they did, and I think it'll warm your hearts, especially yours, Clint, is that they put movies on the side of City Hall out in the cold and watched them. So they managed to do a communal outdoor theater experience, these protesters, to give them something to get through the night. And so I don't disagree that movies can have that. I just don't think that we are going to be using buildings the same way. I think we're going to find other more creative ways to get that social experience back that we've all been missing so much. And it might not just be in these super multiplex places, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. One of the things that's great about DC is they have a lot of different communities have exactly what you described there in the summer. They used to do it down on the National Mall. They called it Screen on the Green. And they would show classic movies every week. And different communities now have taken that up and are projecting movies on the sides of big buildings. And it's great. It is really neat to see how the communities come together for those events. But I just don't think it's going to compare for me personally to being in a dark theater, maybe in the back row, maybe in the middle, somewhere in the dark with a bunch of people watching a movie.
Emma, one of the interesting things that people have noticed within, let's say, footfall in the UK is that smaller towns haven't noticed the big drop off that the larger cities have in terms of human traffic. And that is in large part because we kind of are against chains now, aren't we? There was this backdrop of people being anti-chains, being much more independent retailers, and those smaller towns have those independent retailers. It looks like with the collapse of these large retailers that we're going to see an acceleration of independent retailers. So surely this is actually going to be a good thing for the UK high street.
I don't know. I mean, I think that's a very utopian way of looking at things. I mean, I know you're you, but I don't see independent retailers getting the insurance to go and set up in a big, you know, on Oxford Street or whatever, where, you know, the big Dorothy Perkins is closed down. You know, that's big retail. That's big real estate. I think that what we'll see is much more dispersed high streets in places like where I live. We've already got a lot of independent retail around here because it's getting very shishy. I mean, Walthamstow already is. Leighton is up and coming. I live on the border of the two. Yeah, we're turning into bloody Shoreditch. Two people working in a nice little candle boutique is not the same employment-wise as 200 people working in a Dorothy Perkins, and that's what concerns me.
But aren't we seeing the end of high street clothes shops? I was always really struck coming to San Francisco 6 years ago that I thought it was all going to be strip malls and chain shops. And actually, because of local civic legislation, they've really legislated against multiples. So you can still have clothes shops here, and you can have the butchers, you can have the bakers, but it's experiential shopping in a way that we don't really get within the UK. UK high streets are dominated, at least traditionally have been dominated, by the same old brands, whether it's Boots or PC World or Topshop, whatever. Whereas I'm really surprised in Northern California, every high street is radically different and has its own kind of unique charm.
I think the problem is what we're losing is the mid-level fashion, your Topshops, your Dorothy Perkins. But TK Maxx is going nowhere. You know, your £6 made in a sweatshop T-shirt, you're going to be able to buy plenty of those. And that's a problem.
And Primark, yeah. As someone who's a proud son of Birmingham, and the fact that Birmingham has had billions of pounds of inward investment for new shopping malls and new retail areas of the city, that potentially Birmingham is going to have a catastrophic crash in the next 2 or 3 years. But I'm somewhat optimistic that small and medium-sized retail will actually come in and swoop in and actually save the city of Birmingham, as well as HS2. But as Emma has said, I am me and I'm an eternal optimist. On that note, have we seen the end of the high street or the main street? Are we going to go on to our last topic, which is the vaccine in Canada?
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
For months, Canadians have been told a return to normal would only begin once a COVID-19 vaccine was approved. At long last, that day has come. Late this morning, Health Canada announced the news that the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine has been approved for use in Canada.
Health Canada's authorization of the first COVID-19 vaccine in Canada.
Dr. Supriya Sharma, Health Canada's chief medical officer, says this is a milestone in the fight against COVID-19.
Health Canada approved this vaccine through an interim order pathway that allowed us to accelerate the overall review process while still applying our rigorous standards for safety, efficacy, and quality, and making our decision based only on science and evidence.
Today, Pfizer says they will be ready to ship vaccines to Canada as soon as they receive the green light from Health Canada to begin distribution.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced 2 days ago that almost 250,000 doses of the two-dose Pfizer vaccine will be ready before the end of the year, following approval from Health Canada. Laura, what can Canadians expect now that the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine has been approved in your great country?
We can expect it to be distributed in a pretty orderly fashion. Just here in Ontario, they brought in one of our top retired military people, and they're already running national and provincial distribution pilots and practices. We have a pretty strong healthcare system here. There are areas of the country, of course, that are more remote, and they've already got a plan for getting those vaccines there. They've prioritized who is going to get it, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of pushback about that. If anything, the pushback came from other parties saying that Trudeau was saying the timeline was, you know, not ambitious, or Trudeau wasn't being ambitious enough. Frankly, I thought Trudeau was managing expectations, you know, telling us that we'd all get it sort of by September, and then, whoa, well, wait a sec, we have it coming now, right? So I think that Trudeau is just always trying to underpromise and overdeliver, and it works well for him. Most Canadians are pretty pleased that our government procured, I think, more vaccines per capita than any other government in the world. We might not be first in line for all of Pfizer's, but we certainly have a whole lot coming. We've invested a lot in it. So since the beginning of this pandemic, we've thrown money at the problem, and Canada will see how we dig out of it on the other side. We're relying heavily on a kind of a green comeback, I think, economically, but we are expecting to get it. I think most of us expect to be in the second round in April, and I'm holding out hope that by Canada Day, we might be in a position where we've really got this thing under control. But that's where we are. It's a pretty good day. How can you complain about that kind of news?
Emma probably will, because, you know, she's always dark and whatever. And I'm always sunny uplands. I'm just joking, by the way, Emma. The vaccines will be distributed to jurisdictions on a per capita basis. What does that mean in plain English?
That's got to do with population, you know, densities and coming out in the larger areas. Like, the provinces are all waiting for confirmation on the doses they're going to get and how much. This, again, goes back to the Canadian culture. We're a little bit different. I'm not going to say we're the nicest, most sharing people on earth, but you haven't seen a whole lot of these vaccine wars where people are fighting to get to the head of the queue. As you guys would say, there isn't a lot of that. There is some anti-vaxxing in this country, and there'll have to be some good public relations campaigns and public awareness campaigns around the importance of the vaccination. What we're talking about right now really is the possibility of a vaccination passport, and that might get a little pushback, people not loving the idea of having to prove they've been vaccinated to access services. So I'm not saying it's going to be all smooth sailing for us on this, but I am really heartened whenever I get sick of listening to the politicians do press conferences on the vaccine or the virus to hear someone like General Hillier come out and say that he's already running drills to get this thing distributed. So I'm feeling pretty positive about it. And just as a quaint little Canadian note, on our little tiny island of PEI, one of the tuna fishermen realized that his fishery had the deep freeze freezers and called the government, and they called them back, and now the tuna fishery is helping out, right? So,
and just the last word on this for you. I know that in the UK, vaccinations have actually started. A 90-year-old lady was the very first recipient of the vaccine in the UK, to much hoopla. Canada itself has actually had a hand in formulating the vaccine as well. So could you tell us what part Canadian science has actually played in this?
I can't a lot, actually. I can tell you that there is a lot of anger at the government politically, the fact that we're not in the manufacturing business, that our manufacturing capacities have been somewhat gutted over different different governments over the past 20 years. And when we were initially hearing this idea that, you know, the UK was going to start vaccinating before the new year, and we were going to be waiting until September because we don't domestically produce it, there was a lot of anger about that. In terms of our scientific input, I don't want to speak to that with any kind of authority, but I can tell you that after this, there's going to be some reflection on what Canada has done with its own capacity to manufacture and to be self-sustaining, if you will. Going forward in this global competitive environment, we might have the money to buy up a whole lot of it, but if we have to wait to get it because we don't domestically produce it, that might not be something that we want to do going forward. So it'll be an interesting discussion.
Right, let's move on to takeaways of the last 7 days. It's that time where we look at the positive, we look at the upsides. The sun is always rising, never setting on this section of the show. It's takeaways of the last 7 days. As is our wont and tradition, we start with the new boy first, or the newish boy first, because you have graced the show before, haven't you, Clint? We're going to start with you over there in Washington, D.C. What's been your takeaway of the last 7 days?
One of the things I found was the National Constitution Center did a constitution drafting project, and they brought together a group of libertarians, a group of progressives, and a group of conservatives to get them to look at how they would update the U.S. Constitution Constitution and what changes they would make. And I'm a little bit of a Constitution nerd. I worked at the Senate for a long time, and the Senate takes their constitutional duties very seriously. And so it's just really interesting to see all of these different viewpoints and how they envisioned the positive changes that could be made to foster a little bit more productivity and a little bit more unity in the nation by changing the Constitution. And one of the things that was very encouraging was that they all pretty much accepted the Constitution as the basis for what they would work with. Nobody said, let's throw this out. Nobody said, let's scrap the whole project and start over. They all saw a lot of prospect and a lot of potential in moving forward with what we're doing already.
Are you really telling me that they didn't say you need to reinstate the monarch of England as the monarch of America?
Well, it'd be the Queen of America for now. she's not out yet, and I have been enjoying The Crown on Netflix lately. So I don't know. There's some different perspectives there, and there have certainly been some people who, over the last 4 years, have definitely thought that maybe a strong-armed monarchy would not be such a bad thing given the alternative that we were in.
I tell you who believes in that. Definitely Emma Burnell. She's a monarchist through and through, I tell you. She doesn't believe in the rights of the people. Do you, Emma?
Absolutely not, no. Pure monarchy rule, but as long as it's me.
Hey, there you go.
I thought it was you.
Emma Burnell, what's been your takeaway the last 7 days, my dear?
So I'm going to go in a completely different direction from Clint, because I'm still in. It is the... Is it the 11th or the 10th of December? And I have not yet heard Last Christmas. There is a game. I don't know if you play this in the States or if you play this in Canada, but there's a game that we play in the UK called Whamageddon. Ooh. And I have lasted longer this year than I've lasted for a very long time. I've not yet heard Last Christmas by Wham. You have to stay in as long as you can. And I just think this year of all years, just a little bit of silly is what we really, really need. So I'm very proud that I've managed to last this long. It's not anything like Clint's much more intellectual takeaway, but you know what? It's making me giggle.
That's what we need.
We don't exactly have that, but I know I don't consider my Christmas started until I hear the Band-Aid song, Do They Know It's Christmas, and you and Bono do that bit. Then
the
I know that the holiday.
In December, I was driving home and we had Merry Christmas, Everyone by Slade. And there is nothing more magnificent than the last verse of that song, which is when you ride on down the hillside in a buggy you have made, when you land upon your head, then you've been slayed. Okay. A triple pun! Triple pun! Amazing.
You know what?
You're back in the woods, Roy Phil.
You know what I want to say, though? Tonight, thank God it's them instead of you.
That's what I'm talking about. Come on.
Laura Babcock, what's been your takeaway?
Well, let me just give a quick nod to the judicial system in the U.S. That one branch of government seems to be holding up the other two. I'm really happy to see that. There was a point where I didn't think any of them were going to be able to sustain the pressure of this coup. But that's a little bit of light. Actually, I want to address the, you guys are talking about High Street, Main Street. One thing that I think has been good out of this, we've had a terrible response in Canada in terms of the shutdowns, right? It's been a patchwork. It's been inconsistent. It's fallen away from metrics and become totally about appeasement to different groups and constituencies and lobbyists. And especially in Ontario, some industries have completely suffered disproportionately and unfairly. It was okay for a while and then it got really terrible. So a lot of businesses are really suffering and don't think they can make it through in Toronto through another shutdown that's happening, another lockdown. What I have seen in a country where there's a whole lot of big box stores in suburbia and a lot of, you know, big SUVs, and I'm seeing a recommitment to Main Street, to small businesses, to mom and pop shops. It's almost getting to the point of naming and shaming. You know, you're afraid to go to a big box store for the fear of being seen shopping there, which is great for all of the small businesses. So I'm hoping that coming out of this nightmare, we will have reinvested in our local merchants and we will have changed our purchasing habits away from the Amazons of the world and the Walmarts and back to people who actually support our community.
Amen to that, sister. Amen to that. My takeaway, and it kind of came off the back of the Warner Brothers announcement, And yes, as Laura also said as well, we all have our own cinematic setups at home now. I bought a sound bar the other day. My neighbours must hate me, the amount of bass rumble coming out of my speakers at the moment. And I went back and I've watched Captain America Civil War, Winter Soldier, and Thor Ragnarok, and the first Infinity War movie. They are brilliantly executed and conceived bits of entertainment. Now, full disclosure, I'm a big Captain America fan. I literally wear Captain America underpants, right? I love superheroes. I love the baddies getting punched in the face on a big screen, and I love an explosion. But I like to see myself as someone who's somewhat cerebral as well. And Captain America Civil War and Winter Soldier deal with pretty prescient themes, whether it's mass surveillance or whether it is the liberty and the freedom of the individual over the collective, individual responsibility, etc., loss, longing, friendship. These are universal themes, but also deep political themes as well. And in isolation, just watching those, admitting that I come to predisposed to liking the genre because I love a superhero, but stripping that back, Captain America Winter Soldier, great 1970s spy thriller, you know. And I just said to myself, we could actually be looking at the high point of blockbuster cinema with these movies. You know, I'm not saying anything particularly new, but just watching them in the last week really reinforced actually how well conceived these films are, that they work on many different levels. So anyway, that's my takeaway of the week. Go watch those movies again. And just for sheer laughs, watch Thor Ragnarok as well. And there's literally is a gag in every scene. They are brilliant, brilliantly conceived and executed bits of cinematic entertainment. Clint Losey, sir, you're our new boy. Why don't you go first? Tell us where people can find you on social media, sir.
I'm at CM Losey on Twitter.
How about you, Emma Burnell?
I'm at Emma Burnell _ on Twitter.
Laura Babcock, leaving the best till last. Where can people catch up with you on social media?
I'm at Laura Babcock on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram.
Folks, I'm going to put out a shout to you. Please go on to Apple iTunes or a podcatcher of your choice and write us a review. You know what? It'd be your little present from you to us just in time for Christmas. I think there will be another episode, another barnstorming, rip-roaring episode of Mid-Atlantic before Christmas. If by any chance there isn't, have a Merry Christmas. But you know what? Show your want, your need, your desire for more Mid-Atlantic by going on to a podcatcher, writing us that 5-star review. So we need more Clint. That Emma's not bad, but actually, you know what? I quite like that Laura too. And that Roy Field, you know, but as long as it's 5 stars, that'd be awesome. That's us, folks. Don't forget, left of centre politics is right politics. We see you all again soon for another Mid-Atlantic. Tatty bye, tarara bit, toodle pip. Bye-bye.
Last Christmas, I gave you my heart, and the very next day you gave it away. This year, to save me from tears, I'll give it to someone special. Last Christmas, I gave you my heart, and the very next day you gave it away. From tears, I'll give it to someone special. Once bitten, twice shy, I've kept my distance, but you still caught my eye. Tell me, baby, do you still recognize me? It's been a year, it doesn't surprise me. Merry Christmas, I wrapped it up and sent it with a note saying I love you and I meant it. Now I know what a fool I've been, and if you kiss me now, I know you'd fool me again. Last Christmas, I gave you my heart, and the very next day, you gave it up.
eyes I'm hiding from you. And a soul of eyes. My God, I thought you were someone to rely on. Me, I guess I was a shoulder to cry on. Face of the lover with a fireless heart. A man on a cover, but you tore me
of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.